So I'm really glad you introduced me to Keisha because I did not know her or her work, and she's amazing. And now I'm suddenly into her writing.
Keisha Schlegel.
How
Yes.
did you meet her before you had read her work?
Yes, because her book just came out in October of last year, October 2018. So I'm close with her husband, Rob Schlegel, and he's a poet, and I've hosted him for readings in Lincoln, Nebraska years ago. I ran a reading series there, and he was actually the first person that we hosted, me and my friend Trey. I went on like a tour with him in 2014, him and the poet Emily Kendall Fry. So I knew Rob first, and he, not a lot, but would mention his wife's work. How, well, I mean, we're poets, so he mentioned kind of the poetical and kind of lyrical qualities. And so I think I met Keisha, couple, I don't know, maybe 3, 4 years ago. But she, I hadn't read a whole lot of her writing. So when Fear Icons came out, I was really excited about it. Because I'm writing mostly essays now, too. And it's the interesting thing about the book. I mean, I guess there are a number of interesting things, but it's a book about fear and it's a book about cultural icons and the way she marries those concepts in this one fairly short kind of volume is pretty impressively wild to me. So, it was great to talk to her, but to talk to her through that prism too, I thought was particularly interesting.
All right, Keisha. Welcome to the steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like,
A good intonation?
well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah,
Do I put this on?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's in
You're
your
so fuzzy.
So you'll probably have to scoot a little bit that way.
Sure.
Can you want to just talk a little bit?
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
How's it going? I don't know what to say.
Do you ever get really loud?
Yeah, and I'll try to, if like sometimes, yeah.
Yeah?
I'm sorry.
No, it's just do it.
Mostly,
Let me see what it sounds like.
I don't know what it'll sound like. Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's
That's
perfect.
probably how
Great.
it'll sound.
What about Jeff?
Whoa, hello.
Jeff's always loud. That's the problem. I'll turn Jeff down.
Solution.
Right
now. This is crazy.
Yeah. Isn't it not? It's kind of like I've heard people describe it as it's a weird, surreal, because you're listening to something that sounds like somewhere else, but you're there.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Including your own voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end, Keisha, do you want to read a little bit?
I'll do whatever the peoples want me to do.
And it is awkward that we're in a row, but I'll try to scoot back so you can look at Jeff sometimes.
Okay, that'd be good.
Hey, Keisha.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much is going on. How are you?
I'm amazed by this dude in the cowboy hat that's across from us in the studio.
That's the benefit of Kabo. You get a wide medley of characters.
It's like not only do I have your disembodied voices in my ears, but we're like watching someone else like talk into the mic.
Well, they're doing the real show, the real Kabo shows.
Right.
Yeah.
Joaquin Phoenix. Why?
Well, should we set it up a little bit? Maybe you should set up. Why did
we're gonna
why
come
did,
back to setting up? I
why
guess
did
I'm curious.
Jeff just bring up Joaquin Phoenix?
Oh man,
and you?
I think that would be a question for Jeff. there are a lot of essays to choose from, but Joaquin got your interest.
No, I mean I'm that was just that was one that has an interesting structure. I mean, I guess it was also one. In terms of music,
okay, so I'll explain what Jeff's not. You have a series of essays called Phoenix.
Dear Phoenix.
Series of letters, yeah.
Letters,
right.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's kind of dreamy. That's A. I mean, I'll just be honest. But B is, I was really sleep deprived. And had like a newborn. What's the timing on this one? Oh, she wasn't a newborn. She was a little older. Felt like a newborn still.
Kids are tiring.
Kids are exhausting. And I had two of them. And so I would escape by going to watch movies. I just like go into my room, close the door, put on the headphones, and watch movies. And like I did not care what the movie was. Mm-hmm. And then I saw this movie, Her, and there was something about it that just like the mind frame I was in, it just struck me. Because in part I had heard about this movie before I had seen it. And there was all this weird dynamic happening with my friend Jessica, who had been talking about him one night. And there was just like this like shadowing of him kind of over some conversations that were happening over kind of a period of time. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I think I wasn't able to see the movie for a while. And then I finally did. And it just felt like someone I could write to who had figured something out. And I felt like I could write to him because I didn't think he would ever read what I had written.
Right.
And there was like a real freedom in that. Mm-hmm. And also the letter as a form for the essay is really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Like the epistolary essay is just fascinating to me, especially as a writer. I can talk more about that in a minute. But so I don't know why. I think I was feeling kind of stuck as a writer. And I was just feeling kind of trapped in my own exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And so he was kind of a way to get out of it, to just write letters to this person that would never respond and that I would never mail. Although I did get...
Oh, you didn't mail them.
I did get kind of weird and like find his address. Which
you should mail them.
I think I did. I did find it. I didn't want to.
Well, just now like, you can mail him your
book. You found his address via the World Wide Web?
Yeah, it was a little too easy.
Oh, interesting. Really?
Yeah, it was a little weird. Yeah, I just...
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you have a relationship with him before Her?
We go way back. Yeah, we met in 1982 as children.
Did you like his movies? I mean, in this, did you?
Because
like
you talk about.
Well, I remember when I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, I drove to Omaha to see his movie that Casey Affleck directed, I'm Still Here. And it was at this really, and it was the one where Joaquin Phoenix turned into a rapper. And I remember less the movie than kind of just like going there with my friend Joshua and kind of the trip, because it was a really bad movie theater as well. It was somewhat dirty and damp, and I guess they're all dark. But
hopefully
you mentioned that in here. I guess, did you like other of his films, or was it just because, I mean, there's also a really interesting Giacomo Cometti quote that I really like in this essay. But
yeah. What was the movie he was in? Oh, man. No, I'm not going to remember.
The I'm Still Here one?
No, it was before that. With Philip Seymour Hoffman. That guy.
Oh, The Master.
It's so good. That was the last thing I had seen him in.
Paul Thomas Anderson, The Master.
It's so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was so good in it.
He was.
And he just seemed so fearless.
Uh-huh.
Like, just willing to make whatever. And so I read a couple interviews with him. And that got me interested.
Prior to writing this?
Well, while writing this.
Okay.
Yeah. It got me interested in his process and like how he thought about acting and how I might use that to free myself from this trap of exhaustion I was in to start writing again.
Did you have that with other actors, or was he the only one that's
no
sparked you in a way?
I think he's the only... Yeah. At that moment in time, yeah, for sure. He was the only one. I mean, there are lots of actors I really adore. Like, I started to write one of these essays to Tilda Swinton, but that it fell apart, so I didn't write that one. I didn't finish it.
Well, and I guess this essay, because, I mean, can you just structure this book for the listeners? Like, what? It's called Fear Icons, but how does it kind of work, I guess, in the title?
Yeah, so essentially I was writing a lot about cultural icons. And then one of my friends said, you know, I think you're actually writing about fear. And I went, oh, I am. So I just took up that kind of charge and decided to write about fear through the lens of icons, whether they're cultural or they could be places, people. And I did that for a few reasons. One was the icons gave me enough distance to think about fear, but also I really wanted to situate myself in the feelings of fear I was experiencing. I started this book 8 years ago when my kid was born, my first kid. And I was feeling a new depth of fear that I had not experienced before. All of those fear nerve endings were just wide open in a way that I just had not experienced.
So did you say, was this your first kid?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, totally.
Well, I have a kid and I remember being terrified.
Exactly.
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't have a kid.
Yeah, we're having a conversation here, too. Sorry.
Dog.
I don't know. Maybe I felt a little bit like this when I had a dog, too. But not quite no. to the level.
No.
You know, like, I had made a person with my body. Mm. And yeah. it was suddenly like I was responsible and felt a depth of love for that being that I had not quite experienced before. And it was suddenly very clear to me that I had a lot more to be afraid of, specifically his death. And,
right.
the, you know, it was just immediate for me, that fear. So the icons were a way to think about the fear and a way to inhabit it, to just see what else might come. Because there's this idea, right, that if you feel fear, you get over it, you move on. And that wasn't working or resonating with me. I was really interested in staying with it to see what language might come from it. Because I think also what interests me is the way in which when you feel fear and you're in the midst of it, kind of aphasic. You're sort of without language.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in the tension between that moment of aphasia and what might come from it if I stayed with it, what language might actually come from it. So the icons were just a way to help me get mm-hmm. there. Like they were a lens, a little bit of a path.
Mm-hmm.
And also super interesting to me. Like every individual I write about in this book was just one that I couldn't stop thinking about. So including Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, right. And I mean, I guess we start there, but there's from Ozzy Osbourne to Dolly Parton to Donald Trump to Jesus to Osama bin Laden. I mean, there's a whole plethora of cultural icons, as it were,
mm-hmm.
encased in this book.
And when you were thinking about, and I hope I'm not getting the Phoenix brothers mixed up, when you were thinking about Joaquin, did you go back and watch Space Camp?
Oh my God, never heard of that.
It's amazing. It's a great 80s movie. I believe his first movie when he was like 8.
Space Camp.
He's so good. And this is...
Joaquin Phoenix's? You sure it's Joaquin Phoenix?
No, I'm not sure. But all I know is I was watching it with my kid because I was like, he's getting to an age where he's into space. And I was, and I had this vague memory of when I was a kid. I was like, there was some movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Space Camp is... an 80s movie about a bunch of kids that go to a space camp, which is a real thing. You can learn about astronauts and see what it's like in a shuttle. But in the movie, something goes wrong and they get launched into space.
Mm.
And they have to deal with that and try to survive and get back down. And Joaquin's one of the kids. And about halfway through the movie, I recognized his lip. That's Joaquin, right?
Uh-huh, right.
And that's when I was like, oh, I know that kid as an adult. You should watch it.
Isn't that funny how we say... I know them, or what's your relationship with them? I mean, clearly they're human beings, but we don't actually, like, I don't actually know Joaquin Phoenix, but I'm writing a letter to him. It's so weird.
Mm-hmm. But it's not such to a him, weird it's dynamic. To the idea of him. I mean, if they were just straight up letters to him, I don't think it would be as interesting.
Absolutely.
And then
which is even more troubling.
It.
Like, it, in a way, it's even more troubling. Like, I continue to use him as sort of a means through which to think. And he's actually a human being, which the book considers too, right? Like the ways in which that causes me to feel afraid, the ways in which we see each other as these things to think with, you know, rather than actual beings.
Yeah, I can't imagine how exhausting it would, or maybe exhausting isn't even the word, just confusing to be a celebrity.
Totally.
Where everybody thinks they know you.
Especially since you're a kid, yeah.
Oh yeah, starting as a kid.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, why Joaquin though? Why is that the one that you're like, that's the one I want to talk about?
I was wondering that too, because we talk about music usually.
I know, right?
Jeff.
I mean, I guess he decided to be a rapper, but that was all a farce, right?
Sonny and I were talking about this essay 40 minutes ago.
I see.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't bring it up.
Distance yourself.
It's right in the middle. It is the only epistolary. It reminds me of Letters to Wendy's, the Joe Winder.
Oh, I've got that book.
Absolutely.
But that's let's talk about music.
It happens in Portland. It happens a little
happens
bit in Portland.
Happens in Portland, the first one. Yeah, or was some of them.
You just drove here from Walla Walla?
Yes.
What? So this was, unfortunately, the mics were off and we were in a different room. You had a great description of your drive. I won't make you repeat it, but I was curious, what brought you guys to Walla Walla?
Oh, Jobs.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense.
I work at Whitman College, and my husband, Rob Schlegel, is a poet, and he taught there for a couple of years, and then they had a nonfiction position open up. I applied for it thinking it was a major long shot and that I'd have a really good experience. I'd learn a lot from the whole thing.
Right.
And I worked really hard, and I think I was just so calm about the whole thing because I didn't think I'd get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I got it. I was like, you know, it's, they're going to interview me a bunch, and I'm going to learn so much from the interviews. And
that's a good perspective.
So nice that they're interviewing me. And I think I just nailed it because of that. But anyway, so yeah, so we've lived there for a long time now. It feels like seven years.
Am I right? Is Walla Walla the place that's famous for their onions?
Yes, and wine.
Oh, I didn't know about the wine.
Yes, Walla Walla sweet onions.
Mm-hmm. Very sweet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny, too. We just interviewed the writer, Sam Whipside, who said the exact same thing about his job at Columbia.
Yeah.
He said that he didn't think he was going to get it. He went in there with no expectations, and he kind of nailed it. Do you know a stand-up comic in Walla Walla who has an alpaca named Nathan?
No, but I would like to.
Okay.
They have
I saw
alpaca?
A stand-up set last week, and he lives in Walla Walla. Or maybe he doesn't own the alpaca. The alpaca was on his land.
That's good. Different. So here's my naive. Walla Walla. Is an alpaca like a llama?
Yeah, what's the difference? Is it a kind of llama?
I don't know.
I think an alpaca is... a llama.
This is great radio. We've got some music.
We got some music lined up. We have your playlist, so we can talk about that.
We were very entertaining without the mics. I'll just say that.
Is it too early to start with music? How do you guys feel?
I'm in.
I'm here for all the music.
Oh, that's nice. Well... I'm just going to play something. This is a list that you came up. Do you actually want to first say something about this list that
I made a list of songs that really influenced the book, mostly individual essays. So clearly the song Jolene influenced the essay on Dolly Parton. But there's some that are a little less straightforward. So yeah.
When you say influenced... there's so many different ways that could be come about. Were you listening to it while writing it? Is it something that are some of them just songs that have been around forever? Maybe you can't. Maybe it's a different answer for everyone.
No, I think it is a different answer for everyone. So for some of the songs, I was listening to them while writing.
Mm-hmm.
For some of the essays, the song became the ending, the closure, the epiphany, the way to get to where I needed to go. And for some of the essays, music was something I wanted to do. I wanted to play music through the essay. So I wanted the essay to sonically be like a song. I wanted it to sound like a song.
That's nice. I'm going to play one because I can see you're cold and you need to put on your jacket.
Yeah.
It's cold in here.
It is cold.
Okay. Here's the first one. We'll listen to a little bit.
So weep not for me, my friend, when my time below does end. For my life belongs to him who will raise the dead again. It don't matter where you bury me. I'll be home and I'll be free.
All right, so that was All My Tears by, I'm going to say this wrong, Anna Brun?
I think Ani Brun.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Ani.
Yeah, I think. I'm not actually sure. And Emmylou Harris also sings a version of that song that is pretty different. Very cool to listen to next to each other. So that song I first heard while watching Peaky Blinders. You seen that show?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So the
first two seasons I loved, and then I got sick of it.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
So there's a moment where it's a very pivotal scene. I'm not going to describe it because it would give away a lot. But that song just started playing, and it just about broke me when that song was playing over the image. And I, for a long time, tried to weave that song and that moment in Peaky Blinders into the essay That's the first one, the Jesus essay.
Mm-hmm.
And it just never was going to work. It was never going to work. And I think I have 20 drafts with me like describing the scene and like describing the song. And it just fell apart every time. So that is one of the songs that's very background, very informative, mm-hmm. but not actually present in the essay. So you never know that that song was connected to Jesus. But for me, it definitely is. And the lyrics are also, you know, very related to, if I believe in you, I'm going to be saved. It won't matter where you bury me because I'll be with you, Jesus, kind of thing, which is, you know, in contrast to my own personal beliefs. And yet it's such a moving, beautiful song to me. I just listen to it over and over.
Did you... As I said, I really enjoyed that show, too. The only thing that bugged me, the music is great, but it's for a while, it took me a while to get used to the fact that they were playing contemporary music in a period. How did you feel about that?
I love it.
Oh, you were into
it? Well, yeah, because most of it's P.J. Harvey.
Yeah.
It's just like P.J. Harvey over every scene in life is how we should be living, I would say, you know.
All right.
All the P.J. Harvey all the time.
I can buy that.
Mm-hmm. Now, why, I guess I'm curious just in terms of why this essay at the beginning? I mean, because Jesus is the height of cultural iconism?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, this has a lot of questions. It kind of gets into, do we get into your kind of lack of faith towards the end, or do we get that later on in the book?
I mean, definitely in this essay, I talk about my lack of faith.
Okay, so that comes in here.
Sort of the initiating moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was the last essay I wrote.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I had completed the whole book and I had the structure for the book, and starting off with Bin Laden was really problematic for a bunch of reasons.
Oh.
So I just didn't want to start with him. And I felt like I needed a little more of an orienting essay.
Mm-hmm.
That would establish the series of questions that the collection would contend with, but also to set a tone and also to, frankly, have a conversation with an icon that most people think of when they think of icons.
Mm-hmm.
Other than Mary, it's mostly Jesus. And I had totally neglected Jesus.
Right. As many of us do.
Right. And Jesus didn't want to be neglected in this collection. So, so it led to this essay.
Did you grow up in a religious household?
I did, yeah. My granddad's a preacher in the Disciples of Christ Church, which is, you know, as religions go, as far as I perceive it, it's a pretty cool one. They're very open-hearted. They don't have a creed. There's not like one way to believe, but you're still believing in Jesus as your personal savior. So yeah, I went to church every Sunday. My mom still goes to church where I went to church, sang in the choir, did the whole thing. And it just didn't really resonate with me. By the time I was 12 or 13, I was really struggling.
Mm. Kind of young then, 12, 13, that's relatively young.
Yeah, and I mean, this essay also, it's a series of questions because I'm already questioning what mm-hmm. the role of this particular religion will be in my life. And this was sort of the beginning of that struggle, was when I asked a question in Sunday school class and the teacher kicked me out for being too aggressive in my line of questioning.
What was the question?
Well, it's in here. Oh. So, she was telling us that Jesus died for our sins and that God so loved the world that he gave his only son, right? And so I said, well, what kind of love is that? I was just really questioning her definition of love and what it means to love and mm-hmm. what one must give in order to love. And that was when she'd had enough of me.
That's such a good question, though. You're like, who gives away their child to show love? That's absurd.
Right. Who lets them die?
Yeah.
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 So... But I think, too, I was pretty, let's be honest, I was a pretty sassy kid, too. You know, I was probably being very annoying. So she definitely had just enough of me altogether. So
where did you grow up?
Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah, Tucker, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta, about 20 minutes. Yeah.
that goes into the Bin Laden one.
Mm-hmm.
Analyzed by Tom York.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
It got me writing.
That song got you writing?
Yeah. I would listen to it and just start writing. And there's no like bigger
That's
reason.
Just it?
Yeah, it mm-hmm. just prompted me. And I listened to that same song again for Empire Builder, which I think is interesting. There's like a beat in the background that feels a lot like a train. And so it was useful to listen to that song as well when I was writing Empire Builder. But for Bin Laden, I was listening to it just to get me writing and mm-hmm. just to start some sentence because whenever I would feel stuck.
Do you listen to me when you write? Is mm-hmm. that, I mean, so that's what we're talking about? Like you would put that on and that yeah. would be like, so you can do both. You can have that dissonance.
Yeah. But if it's a song I really know.
Okay.
So I'm not thinking about the lyrics.
And you listen to the track, like you put it on repeat?
No, I have like a writing soundtrack. Like I have a bunch of songs that will play, many of which I've shared with you. Mm-hmm. That I would listen to while writing this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I can definitely get that. The Tom York song we just heard has a kind of drive or a rhythm that is what I often think of as this is great driving music,
uh-huh.
which is also great writing uh-huh. music because you need that like just focusing, moving.
Totally.
Not being static.
Yeah. There's the rhythm. Mm-hmm. It gets you thinking differently. It just makes it feel possible too, you know. Like
I can actually write.
Yeah, and also here's something I admire, and at one point someone wrote this and made it, and it I can feel it in my body. My hand starts to move. Yeah.
Does it ever overtake what you're writing though?
Yeah, totally. So I'll just turn it off. Right. I'll just turn it off if that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't always listen to music.
Right.
It just varies. Because sometimes it will just really interrupt what's happening in my head.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to hear that you don't listen to one, but you have a playlist, because I could imagine some songs will be just the right mood, then something else comes on, you're like, oh, no,
yes.
No, we're not there.
Sure, yeah, I think that does happen. Yeah.
I guess one of the things I'm curious about, too, is not directly musical, but I mean, you know, a lot of the essays in this are very, and I don't love the word, but lyrical.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they kind of refuse closure in places.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband's a poet. You quote in these shadow texts, which I want to talk about a little bit. You quote a lot of poets. I mean, is that something that you came to over years of writing? Have you always been interested in kind of the, like, I guess I'm asking about the musicality of your own language?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd be okay with calling these lyric essays. Some people do. I think that's fine.
What do you think of that term, lyric essay?
I think it's a way to comprehend the incomprehensible, once again. Like, we're just giving names to stuff so we can look at it.
Make a difference, yeah.
I think if it's helpful to think about an essay as a lyric so that you can, you know, define it as the baby that was made when an essay made love to a poem, then great.
Mm-hmm. So you don't like, because some people blanch at that. Is blanch
fine.
A word?
It's a word, yes.
So I used it right then. I blanched at
or
the
balk.
Dog.
Yeah.
So no, you don't.
I think, like you turn white. Like your face.
Is that
white.
What blanch means?
Yeah.
Well, it's a way to cook vegetables.
You saying I used it wrong?
No.
I think
I'm
you used it like
meeting.
A poet.
Yeah, you used
are we gonna,
it perfectly.
Are we going to define it or redefine it?
Okay, but you wouldn't scoff at that.
No, I mean, I think it's
scoff.
A...
That's not how you use scoff.
That is how you use You're being... Don't... You're angering me.
Should I step out?
No.
So you can, okay.
We need a moment.
You're okay.
Sonny's
you guys are okay.
Okay, Keisha, your turn.
I mean, what do we do with genre, right? We use it to understand what's happening in that genre. But then at some point, you step away and you remember genre comes from a word that means to generate. So why box it in? So let's step back, look at what is the essay? What can it do? What are its parameters? What are the limits? And for me, I was really interested in sound.
Okay.
And really interested in the way that the sentences sound when they are read aloud. So I've read this book out loud probably 400 times.
Each
essay, just like I'm Southern, so I'm being hyperbolic. But just saying, like, I would read each one out loud multiple times before it would feel finished, because I wanted the cadence to feel right. I wanted the sound to feel right. That's why it took so long.
To yourself or to your kids?
Cat.
Or
just
oh, definitely to your kids. Cat. Definitely to myself. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you're definitely, okay, very yeah. sound.
You know and what is I mean? It like actually, as drafting. Yeah.
Is it actually loud or like a mumbling?
If no one's home, I'll just read it in a normal voice.
Wow.
Right? If people are home, I might just whisper it. Yeah, but mostly a normal speaking voice. So it's definitely paying attention to the sound, to the imagery, to the metaphor, to the language, wanting it to feel very compressed, the images to feel very compressed, the narrative feel more like a poem or more like a song,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're short, you know, how mm-hmm. long is a song? 3 to 5 minutes. So they were very influenced by sound. And if there's a spectrum that moves from journalism to poetry and the essay lives along that spectrum, I'm definitely headed towards poetry, right? So I'm very influenced by poets. I've only read poets while writing this book.
You only read poets while writing this book?
Well, only. I mostly read poets.
Now, when you were younger, when you were writing this book, you were reading poets, were you reading essayists back in the day that got you on this road? I mean,
yeah, definitely.
So,
yeah,
because John, how do you say his last name? Degada?
Uh-huh.
Because he's someone who's really kind of questioned what an essay is, right? Yeah. He was one of your teachers?
Yes.
Okay.
And maybe most importantly, put together an anthology called The Next American Essay.
Okay.
And I had a poet named Chris Dombrowski from Missoula, Montana, hand me a copy of that we were at a baby shower. He was like, you got to read this book. And it changed the way I saw what was possible in creative nonfiction. And I felt like I'd found my kin.
Were you were younger at that point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
not that you're old now. I didn't
I was really enjoying the pause. Is that younger? What are you saying?
Well, no, of course I was younger. It was like a decade ago.
Okay. Well, we all were.
That could have been 2 years. I don't know.
No, it was easily a decade ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, and like who is working in that mode that really interests me? You'll find him in the shadow texts. Anne Carson knows how to school anyone on what can be done with an essay and really anything. I think for me, I've had a lot of access to folks who are pushing the boundaries of the essay mm-hmm. and what they can do. And don't think it's weird, right? Like a lot of people will talk about the lyric essays being so weird, but for us, it's just our wheelhouse and it's like a comfortable space in which to play and like learn and have the essay surprise us as mm-hmm. we're writing it rather than plan it out or know where we're going.
Sure. I guess real quick, I mean, you've talked about this in interviews. What is a shadow text in terms of this book? I mean, how does it work?
Yeah.
How do you define that?
So this is a term that I heard Maggie Nelson use. I hope I'm attributing her correctly. She'll probably send me a cease and desist letter soon. But I remember her talking about having a shadow text for the books that she writes, and she'll have the book next to her while she's writing. And I felt that as I was writing each of these essays, that I had these texts that would help me say what I needed to say and couldn't,
mm-hmm.
Or that would kind of redirect me or give me an image that I could then work with. And so those were sort of the shadows that were hovering around me as I was writing. And I wanted to honor those and give them some space. So at the end, that's why I put together this sort of list of shadow texts for each of the essays.
But these two, it's not like, I mean, this is a somewhat, I don't love the word, but an organic process. It's not like you're like, I need a Rilke quote to end this essay. I mean, you were just had, it just kind of came about.
Yeah, and so much of it was happenstance.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, where I would just, I would be writing the essay and then I would go read something and randomly mm-hmm. I would read Adrienne Rich, Knowledge of the Oppressor. This is the oppressor's language. Yet I needed to talk to you. And there it was.
Right.
You know, it's like,
which is kind of magic.
Totally magic.
Yeah.
totally magic, which a shadow is kind of magical. Mm-hmm. So it seems like an appropriate way to describe what was happening. Part of you, but not part of you, with you, but not really. There, if the light's at a certain angle, if you just happen to be in the right place at the right time. And that's definitely what was happening with these particular shadow texts. The Samantha Hunt one, for instance, she's an amazing short story writer and novelist. And I was working on that essay, Mother Mary, and I had just finished reading one of her short stories and then read an interview with her. And then there was that quote.
Can you read it?
When I became a mom, no one ever said, hey, you made a death. You made your children's deaths. Meanwhile, I could think of little else. Right. So I was like, oh, that's what I've actually been trying to say.
That's funny. When I had a kid, I only thought of my own death.
Really?
I certainly saw my mortality. So maybe I'm more selfish. I was like, wow, you're going to have a great life and mine's ending.
Whoa. Okay. Well, I have a dog. Let's get back to that. So
I didn't mean to exclude you.
No, I just hope Finley doesn't come upon this anytime soon.
On that note.
But I did have one more question before we... did you ever feel self-conscious about the fact that you're using all these other writers' words and images? I mean, was there ever a thing like this? Did you ever feel self-conscious about that? This is less mine and it's more I'm giving it to these other people. I mean, was it something that you felt a kinship with?
I never felt self-conscious about it.
Because writers that you like do that as well. I mean, you just kind of know. You mentioned Maggie Nelson. You mentioned, or in interviews, the Argonauts, where she's constantly.
Yeah. I mean, that's formally very much a part of that book as well.
Right.
It's very integrated into the pages along the edges. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't know if that's why I didn't feel self-conscious, though.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like an honoring.
Oh, okay.
And a way of saying, you know, these aren't actually my words. But I didn't want to do it in the everyday usage style that we rely on of having a bibliography and sort
of
your footnotes. And, you know, formally that would have really detracted from what I was trying to do. I don't often feel very self-conscious about writing. I think that the minute I do, I need to stop because the writing's not going to be good. Mm-hmm. And so I need to figure out why I'm feeling that way. I feel super self-conscious when reading, or like in this moment when talking about the book. Like, I feel very hyper aware of my physical presence and also what I'm saying and the relationship I now have to this book, which was basically written 2 years ago, turned in, and now it's like this other object in the world. Like, what is our relationship? Like, that's where self-consciousness comes in for me as a writer. It's not in the writing moment. That was true for this book. So now as I'm moving forward to write the next thing, I feel pretty self-conscious. So I'm not writing anything. So it's like, you know, do you experience this? The self-consciousness when writing?
Yeah. I mean, I remember when sometimes this was before in my pre-life, before having a child, I could wait till there was time to write, like sit around and wait. And I would try to write in the morning and it wasn't working. And I'm like, well, I'll do something else. And it wouldn't come until after dinner. Like, oh, now I feel clear. Mm-hmm. But with a child, you don't have that freedom anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or a dog. Dogs
or a dog.
Are so...
Yes, of course.
They just need walks.
That's right. I love Beckett.
Beckett's wonderful.
It's Beckett Longsnout to you. I can call him Beckett.
Sorry, Mr. Longsnout.
No, but I guess if Sonny didn't want to derail the conversation, I use a lot of shadow text myself. I've never heard that term. I mean, you're the first one to introduce it to me, but I feel I personally never feel self-conscious, but I mean, I guess that's one of the things that interests me about this book, the community that you kind of make the essays with. So I find it, I think it was great. I mean, but I like that, letting people know that you're a part of a continuum and that you're acknowledging that continuum and you're also making that continuum your own while respecting that acknowledgement.
Which also, frankly, felt very important for a subject like fear,
mm-hmm.
which is very isolating.
Sure.
Right? And so to be able to write within that kind of community, I think, and that kinship, as you're saying, felt very warming
right.
and necessary in order to stay with the material and to stay in those moments, I needed to have somebody else there. Mm-hmm. So that was one way to pull other voices in.
Yeah.
So that was the Sonata for Violin and Cello by Ravel. It says performed by Nigel Kennedy, the violinist. It doesn't say who the cellist was, which is kind of rude.
That is rude.
I could look it up.
Also rude that I don't know.
Oh, you know, you don't have to have it all memorized. Right. Maybe he was the more famous player. It's doubtful, though.
And that was from Mother Mary, that one they line up, or loosely line up.
Kind of. I mean, that's another one that was like background music to writing.
Right.
But as I was listening to it just now, I was realizing how much it keeps me from having a thought. Like, I can't form a thought in my head when that's playing. There's something about, yeah, it's got a rhythm that I can't quite follow in a natural way in my head. And so it's like, it's breaking the sentence as I'm thinking it. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. I like that effect that it's having on language in my mind.
Right.
So I don't know how that impacted this particular essay, but I know I've listened to that song a lot throughout writing this collection.
Sure.
And that entire album, actually, which I should know the name of it. I can see the album cover. It's their two faces. Very cute.
Is he the guy that has like the spiky hair?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Nigel,
I don't even know how
hair.
I came across this. I think this is a CD that I got from the library. And when my computer still had a drive, I just downloaded it. And I have no idea. Like, I was like, I need some classical music in my life.
Ravel's.
I need to get some classical. I don't know anything about classical music. So I was like, I'm just going to download a bunch of classical music.
Ravel is amazing. I always want to like him more. Like, it's wildly colorful, but I think you nailed it where there's something about his music that it keeps you from thinking. I mean, I guess great music, you shouldn't be thinking, you should just be experiencing it. But I always have trouble sinking into his music because it's not just busy, but it's hard to grasp.
Yes.
Maybe you have to be French.
Well, also, I'm just trying to think of like how you would walk to that song. Like if you went for a like the walk, you would just look like you were dancing.
I think
if
it's
you really
more
followed the music, right? It shifts physically. It shifts my body's perspective on space.
Maybe I know in the public pool near my house there they have an elderly people hour where you can, there's a current for like the little kids that pushes you, but they have an hour for just older people and any age, but mostly older people. And so you can walk against the current, and maybe Ravel is for that.
Ooh.
Ooh. It's nice.
You
deep
liked it at first, Jeff, but then you weren't sure. That was hilarious.
And he got grossed out.
You were like, ooh.
I have one other Nigel Kennedy story. I also had a CD of Four Seasons that he played. And I remember, and his face was huge on it, and he has this spiky hair. If I'm remembering, I hope it's really Nigel. And I was flying somewhere. I have no idea where. This was a long time ago. But he was in first class, and I saw the hair. And he was, like, charming all the flight attendants. And I just thought, oh, I wish I were a wealthy violinist traveling in first class.
And here I am thinking he wasn't very famous and I'm just like liking his song, but no, in fact, of course.
Well, I'm
weird. Like a, isn't he's totally like a sure either, so.
No, I'm pretty sure. I'm also weird. Most people don't know who he is.
Right. I think that's very cool. I mean, I don't know. That album is just wild. Like they do some stuff on that album that just it breaks expectations in ways that I think are really cool.
You should try Faure, Gabriel Faure.
Okay.
I'm definitely saying the name wrong. His cello sonata, second cello sonata.
I mean, how much do you love the cello?
I like it.
It
a lot.
Sounds like a human.
Eh,
come on.
The
seriously? Have you ever seen someone play cello live?
I mean, I've seen, it's just not my instrument.
No, but have you seen anyone do it live?
I mean, I've never sat like in an audience and just watched someone play cello, but I'm sure it's type of some type of ensemble. I've seen cello. Is it amazing?
Have you ever seen Bob's Burgers?
No.
Do you know who John Benjamin is? Mm. Oh, okay. Mm. Well, never mind.
I haven't seen where. No.
He's a comedian, and Bob's Burgers is a cartoon, and he voices the lead actor. But Jeff, I've told you this before. He sounds exactly like him. And sometimes when he groans, like annoyed like that about the cello, like I'm like, oh, I'm with John Benjamin right now.
Maybe John Benjamin's with me. Maybe you turn it around.
It makes a sound that's so close to the human voice, but it's not a human. It's amazing. And when people play it, they breathe. They take these breaths. Mm-hmm. So it's like you can almost, it sounds like the cello is breathing. Try it live, Jeff, and then tell me
like
you don't
like it. I like
the
cello more than the harp, which
yeah,
I find a little bit too
really
much.
Difficult. Yeah.
I once had a, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you because I think you're going to change the subject. I once had a roommate who played cello, and this is when I was like 20 or something, and I drank way too much one night, and I was wildly hungover the next day, and nothing made me feel better, and he was gone, and I just grabbed his cello. I didn't know how to play it, but I just started bowing the open strings, and it was so comforting. Jeff.
Good talk.
So comforting.
I did want to talk about the Ozzy Osbourne essay.
Oh, well, let's hear the song first. So that was Black Sabbath.
Well, so I grew up in Reno, Nevada, and I was really into Black Sabbath. I had a shirt.
Yes.
I mean, I guess what I liked about this essay, it's very short, but also in a way that I'd never really thought. You hear this lore about rock stars, and I mean, one of the things with Ozzy is, I mean, the way this essay begins. He bit the head off a bat. He bit the head off a dove. But in a way that I've never really kind of seen, I mean, you do in just these four short pages kind of actually put the reader inside the situation about, and I mean, I'm sure this involves some historical research. If you had a bat right now and bit the head off it, it wouldn't be a piece of lore. It would be an actual thing,
mm-hmm.
horrific kind of happening. And it's tied in with your own, I guess, with your own kind of religious kind of upbringing as well. But this was one that, for someone who, I don't think I ever worshipped Ozzy Osbourne or Black Sabbath, but I really like them. And this is the first piece that I ever really, it's bad to bite the head off a bat. It's not a good thing. I mean, it's something that, you know, is used now. But I mean, you kind of, I thought it was, and this, I'd like you to read the last sentence, which is also the last paragraph of this. But, I mean, you can talk before about what got you interested. I don't know. I guess there's no question there. You're now you have to answer.
That was just really nice to hear you talk about it as somebody who is such a big fan.
I mean, I like, yeah, I was. Yeah.
I didn't really know. I knew nothing about Ozzy Osbourne truly until this, like, televangelist was on the screen telling us that he was the devil. And then that was the talk around the church was how to keep our young kids from listening to this devil music. And
this is like in the late 80s? I mean, this is when this stuff happened.
Right. Yeah. Probably the mid 80s. Okay. Like, I remember, I think I was like 10 or something.
Yeah.
Late 80s. Yeah, you're right. So I was like, wait, who's that? And then I had a friend who knew a lot about music and was very clear about who Black Sabbath was and who Ozzy Osbourne was. So it became like this myth for kids, mm-hmm. our age, my age at the time, and was just super interesting, and so we couldn't turn away from it. And then I just feel like as an adult, I wanted to return to that idea. I started writing this essay when Ozzy's show was really popular. Mm-hmm. That
the Osbournes
reality thing.
Yeah, his reality television show, which I never watched. I saw clips on YouTube and stuff, but he seemed so all the things. He just mm-hmm. seemed like a human in this reality show and a little bit confused about where the trash bags were and
right.
like didn't know how to put them in the can and just was like kind of struggling and mm-hmm. also like this really big rock star and people were still like coming and talking to him about being a rock star and he would put on the rock star hat and be that person too. And so I just wanted to learn more about him. So I researched him and read a lot of news articles and watched a lot of pretty cool footage actually of him being interviewed in like the late 70s and 80s. Where he would talk about music, but then he would always do something kind of wild in the interviews just to unsettle everything, unsettle right. the terrain of the interview. And I really respected that. I thought it was really great. But then I found these photos that were taken. There's like this sequence of photos where he bit the head off the dove.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, first of all, believe these photos existed and that I'd never seen them. They are incredible. And for all sorts of reasons. But so it just got me very interested in writing about him in a way that I hadn't really read before. And also thinking about what his form of unsettling offers, which really interested me. And also, we should note that biting a head off of an animal is a horrible thing. And if you bite a head off a bat, it will be bad for you because you'll have to have really nasty yeah. shots in your stomach.
I'm not. So you get one of you or both of you. Were these live animals?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the problem. Right.
That's gross.
So, yeah. I mean, the doves were, they were to be released. They went into this like meeting, a very professional meeting with recording executives. And the idea was to release the doves as this sign of peace. But then for some reason, drugs possibly, we don't, right? Like Ozzy decided it would be great just to bite the head off of one. And in the photos, there's a person sitting next to him who's just registering what has happened in these photos and just starts to realize that this has actually happened.
Wait, this wasn't in a show? This was in a meeting with executives?
Yeah.
Oh,
in like a small office.
Huh.
But the bat was, he thought the bat was not real. So he thought it was a rubber bat. Someone threw it on stage and it was, it had frozen. So it wasn't flying around or moving. So he thought that it was rubber and he bit the head off it and realized it wasn't.
I mean, this essay is about Ozzy, but it's also, and I mean, it's kind of what you get at kind of towards near the beginning is it's about before Ozzy Osbourne's Ozzy Osbourne and like when you are innocent like that and when your preacher is saying devil and repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I saw the Blair Witch Project, I thought it was just they just like filmed that and somehow it got made into a movie. And
time.
It reminded me of that, you know, like you're impressionable, you're young. And I mean, these things are scary. So, I mean, it kind of it's about Ozzy, but it's also about the innocence that youth kind of has before Ozzy Osbourne's Ozzy Osbourne, when he can be, you know, the spawn of Satan.
Yeah, or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, that,
right.
that was the disbelief, like that somebody would call somebody else a devil because he made him so uncomfortable. That just seemed really troubling
sure.
to me as a kid. And that was the part, I think, that, you know, kind of solidified my disagreement with religion.
Right.
And the ways in which, especially in the 80s, right, with all the televangelists making tons of money, the Bakers and all those folks, like, There was just a major push to other whoever you could in order to claim your righteousness. And that in itself just struck me as a disaster and really heartbreaking.
Right.
And not something that I could, I don't know, not like, it's not like I was this cognizant, like, oh, I can't be a participant in that. It just struck me as deeply wrong
mm-hmm.
and painful. Like it, I remember just feeling sad, so sad and like aching when I would hear someone talk about someone else as the devil. Oh, he's just that boy's the devil. And so I think it's why you asked about the ending here. That idea of the ache was something that comes back in this essay. And it was something that listening to the song you played kind of helped me understand.
Can you read it? Yeah.
Yeah. So, in this moment, I'm thinking about the song and the way that Ozzy is creating a way for us to think about the ache. So The last paragraph is, in that vibrating moment, the whole of human suffering seemed as if it might come clean out of our mouths to be heard, even as it receded deeper inside, and decibel loved the bones with a sound that might speak for the ache.
Classic
so
track.
Good.
Classic
it's so track. Good. Let's just stop talking and just play it again from the beginning.
R.I.P.
We can.
So good. Do you remember that moment? Did you?
I remember. I remember everyone talking about.
It was
such a big news thing or something that just Nirvana. Everyone was like, "It's the greatest show." The Unplugged Nirvana.
Mm.
They
it
were
was.
Unplugged. It was good.
That was a really good. I mean, yeah. But this is lined up with. The essay about Dick Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather talk about Nirvana, personally.
Who wouldn't?
what new things do we have to say about Nirvana?
That's I have nothing.
Okay.
Just personal stories. Well, I am curious. Is it not? Does it help you when you have people like Dick Cheney? That, of course, for me, I often just try to avoid thinking about them because it just infuriates me. But I could imagine that you will write an essay about them or that's informed by them or something to help you let go of that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in any way true?
Yeah, I don't know about letting go, but I think working through. Mm-hmm. So this essay was influenced by hearing him on the radio. He was giving an interview about how he was possibly going to get a heart transplant, and the sound of his voice was enough to sort of fill me with this very visceral fear and throw me back into the time when he was in power. And I just couldn't get it out of my head. I couldn't get that gravel voice out of my head. And so I just had to write through it. So that's when I started writing this essay. And I was like brushing my teeth when I heard it and then started to just think about, can I be in that fear of this individual who I don't know? And see something good, feel anything other than the fear I feel for this individual. Can I do it? Can I do that? It turns out, no, not so much. I couldn't. So that's the great failure I hope I expose in this essay. But in doing that, I think I did find this moment of commonality with him, but it came through me imagining that he was singing that song. Right? So like, for some reason, I just like, again, totally sleep deprived. Just saw him standing on a stage singing that particular song.
This was a dream, a vision?
No, just like write. I was just writing, just trying to think of him as a human. And I am very nervous when I sing. That's an understatement. And so I thought, well, what if he is too? What if he's scared of singing? Then that's something we have in common. I can have a little empathy towards him. I'm going to imagine him doing that thing. But sure. Then the essay turns and starts to consider how that means I have to imagine myself doing it if I'm going to imagine him doing it in this particular situation. So, so for you to sing, I must sing. And then that song comes in. And the funny thing about this essay is it was one version. It was finished. And then I read it out loud at a reading in Iowa City, and I knew at the end I was going to have to sing this song, and I was so scared. I felt my heart was going to explode, and I was standing on the stage in a dark room, in like a regular theater, and I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. And then I did it, and then I sat down, and I almost passed out.
Gosh.
And I just remember holding a cold beer in my hand and thinking, the beer is cold. I feel a cold beer. I'm going to drink the cold beer. Just trying to be in my body because I was really falling out of it. I thought I was going to faint. I was so terrified by singing in public, and I hated it so much. And I really, my heart was just thumping so, so hard. I went home. I felt awful. I felt sick to my stomach. Just the whole thing you evidently feel when you have a heart attack. And then it is the next morning that I woke up and they announced that Dick Cheney had had a heart transplant the day before.
Hmm.
And I had no idea about that. My friend Lucas Mann, who's also an amazing writer, sent me an email and was like, "You're not going to believe this, but Dick Cheney had a heart transplant. And I think it might have been while you were singing on the stage." That wasn't true, but it was enough to make another section happen in the essay. So that's the kind of weird stuff that happened when I was writing this book. That's a good example, actually, of stuff that would just like show up. And if I paid attention, I could write about it. Same thing with the shadow text that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But it was freaky.
Right.
It was very uncomfortable.
Have you sung since in public?
You know, I joined a choir here last year.
Great.
Resonate Choral Arts, highly recommend them, in Portland, Oregon. They're amazing. The director's name is Kristen. She's awesome. And singing with a large group of women was so empowering. It was amazing. It was really great. But no, I don't sing on my own.
But you're singing with others in that, whereas on
yes.
in Iowa City, you're singing just
on
solo.
A stage. Yeah, yeah, while reading your work. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Should we do one, maybe Jolene, one more song there?
Yeah.
I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene. Of men, but I could never love again. He's the only one for me.
Every time I hear Dolly Parton, I think I need to listen to more Dolly Parton.
Mm-hmm. Especially old Dolly Parton. Hard Candy Christmas. There's so many good albums.
I haven't heard new Dolly Parton, I guess.
So why... No, I wasn't. I have bigger issues at hand. Why Dolly Parton?
Well, growing up, she was sort of a major figure in the South. We went to Dollywood.
Yeah, Dollywood's where?
It's in Tennessee.
What?
It's a it's a theme park, and they have rides. Huh. But mostly, it's where you can go make candles, have funnel cakes, walk into a cabin that's a replica of Dolly's childhood home. It's a one room. It's like one big room, and the tables are all set. And there's, you know, jars all along the wall with the dry goods that they would use to make dinner. There's the fireplace that's not working. There's one bed that, like, the 52 people in the family shared. There weren't that many, okay. But it was still a lot. So, yeah, it's near her childhood home. And so... it was just sort of a place that was also close to where my grandmother grew up. And so we would go visit family in Knoxville, and then we would go to Dollywood. And it was just fun.
Oh, so you went repeated times.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Is Dollywood still open?
Mm-hmm. I think it's owned by someone else now, though.
Okay, but so it was, I didn't.
Yeah, so it was like part of my childhood. And then as was Dolly's music. I wasn't a big country music fan at all. But I could always listen to Dolly Parton when I was growing up. So being a Southerner, I had a lot of family members who would listen to a lot of country music, and that just was not interesting to me at all. I could not stand it. But when Dolly came on, I could get down. She was the real deal for me. I liked her a lot. So yeah, we'd go to Dollywood, and then, you know, as we have aged, she has refused to in many ways, and that interested me a lot when I was writing this collection, and the ways that people would respond to her and her choices that she's made about her body, which she has made very explicit and talks about really openly, which is also against the norm, and the ways in which she uses her humor. I mean, she's so wicked smart about all of the decisions that she's making as an icon who's also very much a human. That is what interested me about her in a lot of ways.
Now, when I read this, I mean, I guess I wasn't sure if you viewed her as a tragic figure, as a sympathetic figure, as a combination of both. I mean, I didn't realize that she was a part of your childhood to a certain degree. I mean, how do you view her?
I think she's herself, and I admire that. But I also have questions about the constructs of a culture that makes someone step into so many surgery rooms in order to look the way she does. That's a major risk, and one that has implications. But I also, who am I to say what somebody should do with their body? That's, you know, I feel like this essay is trying to walk that line that you're naming, and I'm glad you're naming that because that's exactly what it's trying to do. But I have deep respect for her, but it would never be anything I would do, and that's what fascinates me, right? That's right. One of those places where, like, you can deeply respect someone who chooses things so differently than you, does things so differently than you would. That's kind of great. Yeah, but I didn't want it to be like a think piece about like what one should do with her body and what's allowed and what's not. That's why there's that line, like maybe she's just making her body into her own body, you know, like maybe that's all she's doing here, and has the means to do that, to feel comfortable in her body. But I do think it's more complicated than that. You know, when you're a woman who has been a star from a very young age and who is expected to look the way that you look, that's got to come with a different kind of pressure than being Joaquin Phoenix and getting his look. However, I don't know. Does that answer your question?
You said you would never get plastic surgery. Were you turned off by that? Is that too intrusive?
I've never thought about getting plastic surgery.
You've got a deal.
I am now.
Place,
right. Okay. Are you saying because I need to get plastic surgery?
No, I'm not. I thought we were past. I mean, at the top of 135, just what it took that she had her breasts augmented, her lips lined with collagen, the crow's feet around her eyes filled with Botox. She had unwanted skin removed, a chin implant, facial fat grafting, and eyelid lifts. Now at age 71, even the space between her eyes, that tender plane where tiny lines reveal feeling, does not move. Her face hovers between where it's been and where it's going. It lacks time signature. And then it just seems very heavy there.
It just sounds like you're... It's easy... Hearing that, I have to admit, it's very easy for me to not... Like, that brought it to some cold reality. Where I often just think of her like, oh, she's so fun and smart and like confident. Yeah, she can be very funny and she's witty and quick, and it's easy to forget some of that cold reality that you described there. Mm-hmm. But I feel like you ended the interview so perfectly 2 minutes ago. When you brought it back to Joaquin, I was like, oh, there's the bookend. Great.
I can do it again.
All right.
Maybe. I mean, it's interesting, too, if we just step back from this conversation. Like, again, the way that we conceptualize another human being in order to try to understand them, but kind of end up separating ourselves from them to do so. Like, would you ever? What do you, you know, how do we judge that person or think about that person? And I think something I really wanted to do differently in this book is not do that. I don't know if I was successful, but... It was definitely something in my mind, of especially writing about someone like Dolly Parton, whose body is judged on the regular, and those are the questions she gets when she gets in an interview. This is one of the best musicians of our time, and yet these are the questions she gets asked, and it's the discussion that we have, in part because that's what the essay is grappling with. But that's also what the essay is asking us to think about, is the ways in which that is the conversation she's been having her whole flipping life. Even Ellen DeGeneres, right? Like, hands her a mask and says, you know, I think you need this more than... So you can write songs. And she's like, no, actually, I've got it figured out. I know how to put on my makeup and write all these songs and give away over 1 million books to kids who want to learn how to read. So I don't know. Like, when does someone have a conversation with her? And I'm sure this has happened and I just haven't found it. Where's the interview with her where they really talk about being a musician? And what it meant to write a song and cut time, and what it meant to, you know, all those choices she's making as an artist. When do we focus on that? But she also makes that part of what we should pay attention to.
Sure.
You know,
so it's that duality.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have an answer, but But it is interesting to step back and see how that is the discussion we have. Whereas we don't talk at all about Joaquin Phoenix's appearance, except for me at the beginning when I said,
he's gorgeous.
He's really hot. I was like, yeah, he's pretty good looking, right? But we didn't sit there and think about, you know, his face or his body or the way it's changed. And I know that's in part because he doesn't overtly talk about like having changes made to his body. But it's just interesting to me the mm-hmm. ways we still do that. We still mm-hmm. work that way when mm-hmm. we think about gendered bodies. Mm-hmm. They're both really hot, though. Let's
both
just
attractive people. We can just end on that.
Wildly. Well, I'll just ending on attractive. We'll end the show with Because the Night. You gave three different versions. Would you prefer one?
They're all so good.
Yeah.
Because they're also related to me. I don't know. Yeah. Which one do you like?
I was going to go with the 10,000 Maniacs one.
That's the first one I ever heard.
Okay. Jeff, sure. Do you mind? He thumbs up from Jeff. Okay. You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.